She walked on, not looking back, bouncing her ball and holding her dolly by the hair. "Hey!" he shouted after her. She looked back whimsically.
"I beg you, whatchamacallit?"
"The store. Where is it?"
She looked back over her shoulder and said,
"Just the way you're going. It's at the bottom of Up Mile Hill."
Bill felt that sense of the past folding in on itself, folding in on him. He hadn't meant to ask that little girl anything. The question had popped out of his mouth like a cork flying from the neck of a champagne bottle. He descended Up Mile Hill toward downtown. The warehouses and packing plants he remembered from childhood, gloomy brick buildings with dirty windows from which titanic meaty smells issued, were mostly gone, although the Armor and the Star Beef meat packing plants were still there. But Hemp Hill was gone, and there was a drive-in bank and bakery where Eagle Beef and Kosher Meats had been. And there, where the Tracker Brothers Annex had stood, was a sign painted in old-fashioned letters which read, just as the girl with the doll had said, "Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes." The red brick had been painted a yellow which had perhaps been jaunty 10 or 12 years ago, but was now dingy, a color Audra called urine yellow. Bill walked slowly toward it, feeling that sense of déjà vu settle over him again. Later, he told the others he knew what ghost he was going to see before he actually saw it. The show window of Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes was more than dingy. It was filthy. No Down East antique shop, this, with nifty little spool beds and Hoosier cabinets and sets of Depression glassware highlighted by hidden spotlights. This was what his mother called, with utter disdain, a Yankee pawn shop. The items were strewn in rick-rack profusion, heaped aimlessly here, there, and everywhere. Dresses slumped off coat hangers. Guitars hung from their necks like executed criminals. There was a box of 45 RPM records, 10 cents apiece, the sign read. 12 for a buck. Andrew Sisters, Perry Como, Jimmy Rogers, others. There were kids' outfits and dreadful-looking shoes with a card in front of them which read, "Seconds, but not bad, $1 a pair." There were two TVs that looked blind. A third was casting bleared images of the Brady Bunch out toward the street. A box of old paperbacks, most with stripped covers, 2 for a quarter, 10 for a dollar, more inside, some hot, sat atop a large radio with a filthy white plastic case and a tuning dial as big as an alarm clock. Bunches of plastic flowers sat in dirty vases on a chipped, gouged, dusty dining room table. All of these things Bill saw as a chaotic background to the thing his eyes had fixed upon immediately. He stood staring at it with wide, unbelieving eyes. Goose flesh ran madly up and down his body. His forehead was hot, his hands cold, and for a moment it seemed that all the doors inside would swing wide and he would remember everything. Silver was in the right-hand window. His kickstand was still gone and rust had flowered on the front and back fenders, but the Ooga horn was still there on the handlebars, its rubber bulb now glazed with cracks and age. The horn itself, which Bill had always kept neatly polished, was dull and pitted. The flat package carrier where Richie had often ridden double was still on the back fender, but it was bent now, hanging by a single bolt. At some point, someone had covered the seat with imitation tiger skin, which was now rubbed and frayed to a point where the stripes were almost indistinguishable. Silver. Bill raised an absent hand to wipe away the tears that were running slowly down his cheeks. After he had done a better job with his handkerchief, he went inside. The atmosphere of Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes was musty with age. It was, as the girl had said, a attic smell, but not a good smell as some attic smells are. This was not the smell of linseed oil rubbed lovingly into the surface of old tables or of ancient plush and velvet. In here was a smell of rotting book bindings, dirty vinyl cushions that had been half-cooked in the hot suns of summers past, dust, mouse turds. From the TV in the window, the Brady Bunch cackled and whooped. Competing with them from somewhere in the back was the radio voice of a disc jockey identifying himself as your pal Bobby Russell, promising the new album by Prince to the caller who could give the name of the actor who had played Wally on Leave It to Beaver. Bill knew. It had been a kid named Tony Dow, but he didn't want the new Prince album. The radio was sitting on a high shelf amid a number of 19th century portraits. Below it, and them, sat the proprietor, a man of perhaps 40, who was wearing designer jeans and a fishnet T-shirt. His hair was slicked back, and he was thin to the point of emaciation. His feet were cocked up on his desk, which was piled high with ledgers and dominated by an old scrolled cash register. He was reading a paperback novel which Bill thought had never been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. It was called Construction Site Studs. On the floor in front of the desk was a barber pole, its stripe revolving up and up into infinity. Its frayed cord wound across the floor to a baseboard plug like a tired snake. The sign in front of it read, A Dying Breed, $250. When the bell over the door jingled, the man behind the desk marked his place with a matchbook cover and looked up. Help you? Yes, Bill said, and opened his mouth to ask about the bike in the window. But before he could speak, his mind was suddenly filled with a single haunting sentence, words that drove away all other thought. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. What in the name of God? Thrusts? Looking for anything in particular? The proprietor asked. His voice was polite enough, but he was looking at Bill closely. He's looking at me, Bill thought, amused in spite of his distress, as if he's got an idea I've been smoking some of that stuff that gets the jazz musicians high. Yes, I was interested in... His fists against the posts. In that post. The barber pole, you mean? The proprietor's eyes now showed Bill something which, even in his present confused state, he remembered and hated from his childhood. The anxiety of a man or woman who must listen to a stutterer. The urge to jump in quickly and finish the thought, thus shutting the poor bastard up. But I don't stutter. I beat it. I don't fucking stutter. I... And still insists. The words were so clear in his mind that it seemed someone else must be speaking in there, that he was like a man possessed by demons in biblical times, a man invaded by some presence from outside. And yet he recognized the voice and knew it was his own. He felt sweat pop out warmly on his face. I could give you... He sees the ghosts. A deal on that post, the proprietor was saying. Tell you the truth, I can't move it at 250. I'd give it to you for 175. How's that? It's the only real antique in the place. Post. Pole. Bill almost screamed, and the proprietor recoiled a little. Not the pole I'm interested in. Are you okay, mister? The proprietor asked. His solicitous tone belied the expression of hard wariness in his eyes, and Bill saw his left hand leave the desk. He knew, with a flash of something that was really more inductive reasoning than intuition, that there was an open drawer below Bill's own sight line, and that the proprietor had almost surely put his hand on a pistol of some type. He was maybe worried about robbery. More likely, he was just worried. He was, after all, clearly gay, and this was the town where the local juveniles had given Adrian Mellon a terminal bath. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghost. It drove out all thought. It was like being insane. Where had it come from? He thrusts, repeating and repeating. With a sudden titanic effort, Bill attacked it. He did this by forcing his mind to translate the alien sentence into French. It was the same way he had beaten the stutter as a teenager. As the words marched across his field of thought, he changed them, and suddenly he felt the grip of the stutter loosen. He realized that the proprietor had been saying something. Pardon me? I said if you're going to have a fit, take it out on the street. I don't need shit like that in here. Bill drew in a deep breath. Let's start over, he said. Pretend I just came in. Okay, the proprietor said, agreeably enough. You just came in. Now what? The bike in the window, Bill said. How much do you want for the bike? Take $20. He sounded easier now, but his left hand still hadn't come back into view. I think it was a Schwinn at one time, but it's a mongrel now. His eye measured Bill. Big bike. You could ride it yourself. Thinking of the kid's green skateboard, Bill said, I think my bike riding days are over. The proprietor shrugged. His left hand finally came up again. Got a boy?
Yes.
How old is he?
11.
Big bike for an 11-year-old.
Will you take a traveler's check?
Long as it's no more than $10 over the amount of the purchase.
I can give you a 20, Bill said. Mind if I make a phone call?
Not if it's local.
It is.
Be my guest.
Bill called the Derry Public Library. Mike was there. Where are you, Bill? He asked, and then immediately, are you all right?
I'm fine. Have you seen any of the others?
No, we'll see them tonight.
There was a brief pause.
That is, I presume. What can I do for you, Big Bill?
I'm buying a bike, Bill said calmly. I wondered if I could wheel it up to your house. Do you have a garage or something I could store it in?
There was silence.
Mike, are you?
I'm here,
Mike said.
Is it silver?
Bill looked at the proprietor. He was reading his book again, or maybe just looking at it and listening carefully.
Yes, he said.
Where are you?
It's called Secondhand Rose Secondhand Clothes.
All right, Mike said. My place is 61 Palmer Lane. You'd want to go up Main Street.
I can find it.
All right, I'll meet you there. Want some supper?
That would be nice. Can you get off work?
No problem. Carol will cover for me.
Mike hesitated again.
She said that a fellow was in about an hour before I got back here. Said he left looking like a ghost. I got her to describe him. It was Ben.
You sure?
Yeah, and the bike. That's part of it too, isn't it?
Shouldn't wonder,
Bill said, keeping an eye on the proprietor, who still appeared to be absorbed in his book.
I'll see what my place, Mike said. Number 61. Don't forget.
I won't. Thank you, Mike.
God bless, Big Bill.
Bill hung up. The proprietor promptly closed his book again.
Got you some storage space, my friend?
Yeah.
Bill took out his traveler's checks and signed his name to a 20. The proprietor examined the two signatures with a care that, in less distracted mental circumstances, Bill would have found rather insulting. At last, the proprietor scribbled a bill of sale and popped the traveler's check into his old cash register. He got up, put his hands on the small of his back, and stretched, then walked to the front of the store. He picked his way around the heaps of junk and almost junk merchandise with an absent delicacy Bill found fascinating. He lifted the bike, swung it around, and rolled it to the edge of the display space. Bill laid hold of the handlebars to help him, and as he did, another shudder whipped through him.
Silver. Again.
It was silver in his hands, and
he thrust his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
He had to force the thought away because it made him feel faint and strange.
That back tire's a little soft, the proprietor said.
It was, in fact, as flat as a pancake. The front tire was up, but so bald the cord was showing through in places.
No problem, Bill said. You can handle it from here?
I used to be able to handle it just fine. Now I don't know.
I guess so, Bill said. Thanks.
Sure. And if you want to talk about that barber pole, come back.
The proprietor held the door for him. Bill walked the bike out, turned left, and started toward Main Street. People glanced with amusement and curiosity at the man with the bald head pushing the huge bike with the flat rear tire and the Ooga horn protruding over the rusty bike basket. But Bill hardly noticed them. He was marveling at how well his grown-up hands still fitted the rubber hand grips, was remembering how he had always meant to knot some thin strips of plastic, different colors, into the holes in each grip so they would flutter in the wind. He had never gotten around to that. He stopped at the corner of Center and Main, outside of Mr. Paperback. He leaned the bike against the building long enough to strip off his sport coat. Pushing a bike with a flat tire was hard work, and the afternoon had come off hot. He tossed the coat into the basket and went on.
Chain's rusty, he thought. Whoever had it didn't take very good care of
him. It. He stopped for a moment, frowning, trying to remember just what had happened to Silver. Had he sold it, given it away, lost it perhaps?
He couldn't remember. Instead, that idiotic sentence, his fists against the posts and still insists,
resurfaced, as strange and out of place as an easy chair on a battlefield, a record player in a fireplace, a row of pencils protruding from a cement sidewalk. Bill shook his head. The sentence broke up and dispersed like smoke. He pushed Silver onto Mike's place. 6. Mike Hanlon makes a connection. But first he made supper. Hamburgers with sautéed mushrooms and onions and a spinach salad. They had finished working on Silver by then and were more than ready to eat. The house was a neat little Cape Cod, white with green trim. Mike had just been arriving when Bill pushed Silver up Palmer Lane. He was behind the wheel of an old Ford with rusty rocker panels and a cracked rear window, and Bill remembered the fact Mike had so quietly pointed out. The six members of the Losers Club who left Derry had quit being losers.
Mike had stayed behind and was still behind. Bill rolled Silver into Mike's garage, which was floored with oiled dirt and was every bit as neat as the house proved to be. Tools hung from pegs, and the lights, shielded with tin cones, looked like the lights which hung over pool tables. Bill leaned the bike against the wall. The two of them looked at it without speaking for a bit, hands in pockets.
"It's Silver, all right," Mike said at last. "I thought you might have been wrong, but it's him. What are you going to do with him?"
"Fucked if I know. Have you got a bicycle pump?"
"Yeah, I think I've got a tire patching kit, too. Are those tubeless tires?"
"They always were." Bill bent down to look at the flat tire.
"Yeah, tubeless."
"Getting ready to ride it again?"
Of course not," Bill said sharply. "I just don't like to see it's hitting there on a flat."
"Whatever you say, Big Bill. You're the boss."
Bill looked around sharply at that, but Mike had gone to the garage's back wall and was taking down a tire pump. He got a tin tire patching kit from one of the cabinets and handed it to Bill, who looked at it curiously. It was as he remembered such things from his childhood. A small tin box about the same size and shape as those kept by men who roll their own cigarettes, except the top was bright and pebbled. You used it for roughing the rubber around the hole before you put on the patch. The box looked brand new, and there was a Woolco price sticker on it that said $7.23. It seemed to him that when he was a kid, such a kit had gone for about $1.25.
"You didn't just have this hanging around," Bill said.
It wasn't a question.
"No," Mike agreed. "I bought it last week, out at the mall, as a matter of fact."
"You've got a bike of your own?"
"No,"
Mike said, meeting his eyes.
"You just happened to buy this kit."
"Just got the urge," Mike agreed, his eyes still on Bill's. "Woke up thinking it might come in handy. The thought kept coming back all day. So I got the kit. And here you are to use it."
"Here I am to use it," Bill agreed. "But like they say on the soaps, what does it all mean, dear?"
"Ask the others," Mike said, "tonight."
"Will they all be here, do you think?"
"I don't know, Big Bill." He paused and added, "I think there's a chance that all of them won't be. One or two of them may decide to just creep out of town, or..."
He shrugged.
"What do we do if that happens?"
"I don't know."
Mike pointed to the tire patching kit.
"I paid $7 for that thing. Are you going to do something with it or just look at it?"
Bill took his sport coat out of the basket and hung it carefully on an unoccupied wall peg. Then he turned Silver upside down so that he rested on his seat and began to carefully rotate the rear tire. He didn't like the rusty way the axle squeaked, and remembered the almost silent click of the ball bearings in the kid's skateboard.
"A little 3-in-1 oil would fix that right up," he thought. "Wouldn't hurt to oil the chain either. It's rusty as hell. And playing cards. It needs playing cards on the spokes. Mike would have cards, I bet. The good ones. Bikes, with the celluloid coating that made them so stiff and so slippery that the first time you tried to shuffle them, they always sprayed all over the floor. Playing cards, sure. And clothespins to hold them."
He stopped, suddenly cold.
"What in the name of Jesus are you thinking of?"
"Something wrong, Bill?"
Mike asked softly.
"Nothing."
His fingers touched something small and round and hard. He got his nails under it and pulled. A small tack came out of the tire.
"Here's the culprit," he said, and it rose in his mind again, strange, unbidden, and powerful.
"He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts."
But this time the voice, his voice, was followed by his mother's voice saying,
"Try again, Billy. You almost had it that time."
And Andy Devine as Guy Madison's sidekick Jingles yelling,
"Hey, Wild Bill, wait for me."
He shivered. "The posts."
He shook his head.
"I couldn't say that without stuttering even now," he thought.
And for just a moment he felt that he was on the edge of understanding it all. Then it was gone. He opened the tire patching kit and went to work. It took a long time to get it just right. Mike leaned against the wall in a bar of late afternoon sun, the sleeves of his shirt rolled up and his tie yanked down, whistling a tune which Bill finally identified as "She Blinded Me with Science." While he waited for the tire cement to set, Bill had, just for something to do, he told himself, oiled Silver's chain, sprocket, and axles. It didn't make the bike look any better, but when he spun the tires, he found that the squeak was gone, and that was satisfying. Silver never would have won any beauty contests anyway. His one virtue was that he could go like a blue streak.
By that time, 5:30 in the afternoon, he had nearly forgotten Mike was there. He had become completely absorbed in small yet utterly satisfying acts of maintenance. He screwed the nozzle of the pump onto the rear tire's valve and watched the tire fatten, shooting for the right pressure by guess and by gosh. He was pleased to see the patch was holding nicely. When he thought he had it right, he unscrewed the pump nozzle and was about to turn Silver over when he heard the rapid snap flutter of playing cards behind him. He whirled, almost knocking Silver over. Mike was standing there with a deck of blue-backed bicycle playing cards in one hand. "Want these?" Bill let out a long, shaky sigh.
"You've got clothespins, too, I suppose?"
Mike took four from the flap pocket of his shirt and held them out.
"Just happened to have them around, I suppose?"
"Yeah, something like that," Mike said. Bill took the cards and tried to shuffle them. His hands shook and the cards sprayed out of his hands. They went everywhere, but only two landed face up. Bill looked at them, then up at Mike. Mike's gaze was frozen on the littered playing cards. His lips had pulled back from his teeth. The two up cards were both the ace of spades.
"That's impossible," Mike said. "I just opened that deck. Look."
He pointed at the swill can just inside the garage door, and Bill saw the cellophane wrapper.
"How can one deck of cards have two aces of spades?"
Bill bent down and picked them up.
"How can you spray a deck of cards all over the floor and have only two of them land face up?" he asked. "That's an even better question."
He turned the aces over, looked, and then showed them to Mike. One of them was a blue back, the other a red back.
"Holy Christ, Mikey, what have you got us into?"
"What are you going to do with those?"
Mike asked in a numb voice.
"Why, put them on," Bill said, and suddenly he began to laugh. "That's what I'm supposed to do, isn't it? If there are certain preconditions for the use of magic, those preconditions will inevitably arrange themselves, right?"
Mike didn't reply. He watched as Bill went to Silver's rear wheel and attached the playing cards. His hands were still shaking, and it took a while, but he finally got it done, drew in one tight breath, held it, and spun the rear wheel. The playing cards machine-gunned loudly against the spokes in the garage's silence.
"Come on," Mike said softly. "Come on in, Big Bill. I'll make us some chow."
They had scoffed the burgers and now sat smoking, watching dark begin to unfold from dusk in Mike's backyard. Bill took out his wallet, found someone's business card, and wrote upon it the sentence that had plagued him ever since he had seen Silver in the window of Secondhand Rose Secondhand Clothes. He showed it to Mike, who read it carefully, lips pursed.
"Does it mean anything to you?" Bill asked.
"He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts." He nodded.
"Yes, I know what that is." "Well, then tell me. Or are you going to give me some more crap about figuring it out for myself?"
"No," Mike said. "In this case, I think it's okay to tell you. The phrase goes back to English times. It's a tongue twister that became a speech exercise for lispers and stutterers. Your mother kept trying to get you to say it that summer, the summer of 1958. You used to go around mumbling it to yourself."
"I did?"
Bill said, and then slowly, answering his own question,
"I did."
"You must have wanted to please her very much." Bill, who suddenly felt he might cry, only nodded. He didn't trust himself to speak.
"You never made it," Mike told him. "I remember that. You tried like hell, but your tang kept getting all tangled up."
"But I did say it," Bill replied,
"at least once."
"When?" Bill brought his fist down on the picnic table hard enough to hurt.
"I don't remember,"
he shouted. And then dully, he said it again.
"I just don't remember."
Chapter 12. Three Uninvited Guests. 1. On the day after Mike Hanlon made his calls, Henry Bowers began to hear voices. Voices had been talking to him all day long. For a while, Henry thought they were coming from the moon. In the late afternoon, looking up from where he was hoeing in the garden, he could see the moon in the blue daytime sky, pale and small, a ghost moon. That, in fact, was why he believed it was the moon that was talking to him. Only a ghost moon would talk in ghost voices. The voices of his old friends, and the voices of those little kids who had played down in the barrens so long ago. Those, and another voice, one he did not dare name. Victor Chris spoke from the moon first.
"They coming back, Henry. All of 'em, man. They coming back to Derry.
Then Belch Huggins spoke from the moon, perhaps from the dark side of the moon.
You're the only one, Henry. The only one of us left. You'll have to get 'em for me and Vic. Ain't no little kids can rank us out like that. Why, I hit a ball one time down at Tracker's, and Tony Tracker said that ball would have been out of Yankee Stadium.
He hoed, looking up at the ghost moon in the sky, and after a while Fogarty came over and hit him in the back of the neck and knocked him flat on his face.
You're hoeing up the peas right along with the weeds, you idiot.
Henry got up, brushing dirt off his face and out of his hair. There stood Fogarty, a big man in a white jacket and white pants, his belly swelled out in front of him. It was illegal for the guards, who were called counselors here at Juniper Hill, to carry billy clubs, so a number of them, Fogarty, Adler, and Koontz were the worst, carried rolls of quarters in their pockets. They almost always hit you with them in the same place, right in the back of the neck. There was no rule against quarters. Quarters were not considered a deadly weapon at Juniper Hill, an institution for the mentally insane, which stood on the outskirts of Augusta near the Sydney town line.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fogarty,
Henry said, and offered a big grin which showed an irregular line of yellow teeth. They looked like the pickets in a fence outside a haunted house. Henry had begun to lose his teeth when he was 14 or so.
Yeah, you're sorry, Fogarty said. You'll be a lot sorrier if I catch you doing it again, Henry.
Yes, sir, Mr. Fogarty.
Fogarty walked away, his black shoes leaving big brown tracks in the dirt of West Garden. Because Fogarty's back was turned, Henry took a moment to look around surreptitiously. They had been shooed out to Ho as soon as the clouds cleared, everyone from the Blue Ward, which was where they put you if you had once been very dangerous, but were now considered only moderately dangerous. Actually, all the patients at Juniper Hill were considered moderately dangerous. It was a facility for the criminally insane. Henry Bowers was here because he had been convicted of killing his father in the late fall of 1958. It had been a famous year for murder trials, all right. When it came to murder trials, 1958 had been a pip. Only, of course, it wasn't just his father they thought he had killed. If it had only been his father, Henry would not have spent 20 years in the Augusta State Mental Hospital, much of that time under physical and chemical restraint. No, not just his father. The authorities thought he had killed all of them, or at least most of them. Following the verdict, the News had published a front-page editorial titled, The End of Derry's Long Night. In it, they had recapped the salient points. The belt in Henry's bureau that belonged to the missing Patrick Hochstetter. The jumble of school books, some signed out to the missing Belch Huggins and some to the missing Victor Chris, both known chums of the Bowers boy, in Henry's closet. Most damning of all, the panties found tucked into a slit in Henry's mattress. Panties which had been identified by laundry mark as having belonged to Veronica Grogan, deceased. Henry Bowers, the News declared, had been the monster haunting Derry in the spring and summer of 1958. But then the News had proclaimed the end of Derry's long night on the front page of its December 6th edition, and even an idiot like Henry knew that in Derry, night never ended. They had bullied him with questions, had stood around him in a circle, had pointed fingers at him. Twice the chief of police had slapped him across the face, and once a detective named Lottman had punched him in the gut, telling him to fess up and be quick.
There's people outside and they ain't happy, Henry, this Lottman had said. There ain't been a lynching in Derry for a long time, but that don't mean there couldn't be one.
He supposed they would have kept it up as long as necessary, not because any of them really believed the good Derry folk were going to break into the police station, carry Henry out, and hang him from a sour apple tree, but because they were desperate to close the books on that summer's blood and horror. They would have, but Henry didn't make them. They wanted him to confess to everything. He understood after a while. Henry didn't mind. After the horror in the sewers, after what had happened to Belch and Victor, he didn't seem to mind about anything. Yes, he said, he had killed his father. This was true. Yes, he had killed Victor Chris and Belch Huggins. This was also true, at least in the sense that he had led them into the tunnels where they had been murdered. Yes, he had killed Patrick. Yes, Veronica. Yes, one. Yes, all. Not true, but it didn't matter. Blame needed to be taken. Perhaps that was why he had been spared. And if he refused... He understood about Patrick's belt. He had won it from Patrick playing scat one day in April, discovered it didn't fit, and tossed it in his bureau. He understood about the books, too. Hell, the three of them chummed around together, and they cared no more for their summer textbooks than they had for their regular ones, which is to say, they cared for them about as much as a woodchuck cares for tap dancing. There were probably as many of his books in their closets, and the cops probably knew it, too. The panties. Nope, he didn't know how Veronica Grogan's panties had come to be in his mattress. But he thought he knew who, or what, had taken care of it. Best not to talk about such things. Best to just dummy up. So they sent him to Augusta, and finally, in 1979, they had transferred him to Juniper Hill. And he had only run into trouble once here, and that was because at first no one understood. A guy had tried to turn off Henry's nightlight. The nightlight was Donald Duck doffing his little sailor hat. Donald was protection after the sun went down. With no light, things could come in. The locks on the door and the wire mesh did not stop them. They came like mist. Things. They talked and laughed, and sometimes they clutched. Hairy things, smooth things, things with eyes. The sort of things that had really killed Vic and Belch when the three of them had chased the kids into the tunnels under Derry in August of 1958. Looking around now, he saw the others from the Blue Ward. There was George DeVille, who had murdered his wife and four children one winter night in 1962. George's head was studiously bent, his white hair blowing in the breeze, snot running gaily out of his nose, his huge wooden crucifix bobbing and dancing as he hoed. There was Jimmy Donlan, and all they said in the papers about Jimmy was that he had killed his mother in Portland during the summer of 1965. But what they hadn't said in the papers was that Jimmy had tried a novel experiment in body disposal. By the time the cops came, Jimmy had eaten more than half of her, including her brains. "They made me twice as smart," Jimmy had confided to Henry one night after lights out. In the row beyond Jimmy, hoeing fanatically and singing the same line over and over, as always, was the little Frenchman, Benny Beaulieu. Benny had been a firebug, a pyromaniac. Now as he hoed, he sang this line from the Doors over and over. "Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to..." It got on your nerves after a while. Beyond Benny was Franklin DeCruz, who had raped over 50 women before being caught with his pants down in Bangor's Terrace Park. The ages of his victims ranged from 3 to 81. Not very particular was Frank DeCruz. Beyond him, but way back, was Arlen Weston, who spent as much time looking dreamily at his hoe as he did using it. Fogarty, Adler, and John Koontz had all tried the roll of quarters in the fist trick on Weston to try and convince him he could move a bit faster. And one day Koontz had hit him maybe a little too hard because blood came not only from Arlen Weston's nose, but also from Arlen's ears. And that night he had a convulsion. Not a big one, just a little one. But since then, Arlen had drifted further and further into his own interior blackness, and now he was a hopeless case, almost totally unplugged from the world. Beyond Arlen was, "You want to pick it up or I'll give you some more help, Henry?" Fogarty bawled over, and Henry began to hoe again. He didn't want any convulsions. He didn't want to end up like Arlen Weston. Soon the voices started in again, but this time they were the voices of the others, the voices of the kids that had gotten him into this in the first place, whispering down from the ghost moon. "You couldn't even catch a fat boy, Bowers," one of them whispered. "Now I'm rich and you're hoeing peas. Ha-ha and you, asshole." "B-b-Bowers, you couldn't catch a cold. Read any good books since you've been into there?" "I wrote lots." "I'm rich and you're in Judge Juniper Hill. Ha-ha and you stupid asshole." "Shut up," Henry whispered to the ghost voices, hoeing faster, beginning to hoe up the new pea plants along with the weeds. Sweat rolled down his cheeks like tears. "We could have taken you. We could have." "We got you locked up, you asshole," another voice laughed. "You chased me and couldn't catch me, and I got rich, too. Way to go, banana heels." "Shut up," Henry muttered, hoeing faster. "Just shut up." "Did you want to get in my panties, Henry?" another voice teased. "Too bad. I let all of them do me. I was nothing but a slut. But now I'm rich, too, and we're all together again, and we're doing it again. But you couldn't do it now, even if I let you, because you couldn't get it up. So ha-ha on you, Henry. Ha-ha all over you." He hoed madly, weeds and dirt and pea plants flying. The ghost voices from the ghost moon were very loud now, echoing and flying in his head, and Fogarty was running toward him, bellowing, but Henry could not hear, because of the voices.
couldn't even get hold of a nigger like me, could you?"
Another jeering ghost voice chimed in.
"We killed you guys in that rock fight. We fucking killed you. Ha-ha, asshole. Ha-ha all over you."
Then they were all babbling together, laughing at him, calling him Banana Heels, asking him how he'd liked the shock treatments they'd given him when he came up here to the Red Ward, asking him if he liked it here at Judge Juniper Hill, asking and laughing, laughing and asking, and Henry dropped his hoe and began to scream up at the ghost moon in the blue sky, and at first he was screaming in fury. And then the moon itself changed and became the face of the clown, its face a rotted, pocked, cheesy white, its eyes black holes, its red bloody grin turned up in a smile so obscenely ingenuous that it was insupportable. And so then Henry began to scream not in fury but in mortal terror, and the voice of the clown spoke from the ghost moon now, and what it said was, "You have to go back, Henry. You have to go back and finish the job. You have to go back to Derry and kill them all, for me, for..." Then Fogarty, who had been standing nearby and yelling at Henry for almost 2 minutes, while the other inmates stood in their rows, hoes grasped in their hands like comic phalluses, their expressions not exactly interested, but almost, yes, almost thoughtful, as if they understood that this was all a part of the mystery that had put them here, that Henry Bowers' sudden attack of the screaming memes in West Garden was interesting in some more than technical way. Got tired of shouting and gave Henry a real blast with his quarters, and Henry went down like a ton of bricks, the voice of the clown following him down into that terrible whirlpool of darkness, chanting over and over again, "Kill them all, Henry, kill them all, kill them all, kill them all." 2. Henry Bowers lay awake. The moon was down, and he felt a sharp sense of gratitude for that. The moon was less ghostly at night, more real, and if he should see that dreadful clown face in the sky, riding over the hills and fields and woods, he believed he would die of terror. He lay on his side, staring at his nightlight intently. Donald Duck had burned out. He had been replaced by Mickey and Minnie Mouse dancing a polka. They had been replaced with the green, glowing face of Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. And late last year, Oscar had been replaced by the face of Fozzie Bear. Henry had measured out the years of his incarceration with burned-out nightlights instead of coffee spoons. At exactly 2:04 a.m. on the morning of May 30th, his nightlight went out. A little moan escaped him. No more. Coots was on the door of the Blue Ward tonight. Coots, who was the worst of the lot. Worse even than Fogarty, who had hit him so hard in the afternoon that Henry could barely turn his head. Sleeping around him were the other Blue Ward inmates. Benny Bolu slept in elastic restraints. He had been allowed to watch an emergency rerun on the wardroom TV when they came in from hoeing, and around 6 o'clock had begun jerking off constantly and without let-up, screaming, "Try to set the night on fire! Try to set the night on fire! Try to set the night on fire!" He had been sedated, and that was good for about 4 hours. And then he had started in again around 11 when the Elleville wore off, whipping his old dingus so hard it had started to bleed through his fingers, shrieking, "Try to set the night on fire!" So they sedated him again and put him in restraints. Now he slept, his pinched little face as grave in the dim light as Aristotle's. From around his bed, Henry could hear low snores and loud ones, grunts, and occasional bed fart. He could hear Jimmy Donlan's breathing. It was unmistakable, even though Jimmy slept 5 beds over, rapid and faintly whistling. For some reason, it always made Henry think of a sewing machine. From beyond the door, giving on the hall, he could hear the faint sound of Koontz's TV. He knew that Koontz would be watching the late movies on Channel 38, drinking Texas Driver and eating his lunch. Koontz favored sandwiches made out of chunky peanut butter and Bermuda onions. When Henry heard this, he had shuddered and thought, "And they say all the crazy people are locked up." This time the voice didn't come from the moon. This time it came from under the bed. Henry recognized the voice at once. It was Victor Criss, whose head had been torn off somewhere beneath Derry 27 years ago. It had been torn off by the Frankenstein monster. Henry had seen it happen, and afterward he had seen the monster's eyes shift and had felt its watery yellow gaze on him. Yes, the Frankenstein monster had killed Victor, and then it had killed Belch. But here was Vic again, like the almost ghostly rerun of a black-and-white program from the nifty 50s when the president was bald and the Buicks had portholes.
And now that it had happened, now that the voice had come, Henry found that he was calm and unafraid, relieved even.
Henry,
Victor said.
Vic, Henry cried, what are you doing under there?
Benny Ballou snorted and muttered in his sleep. Jimmy's neat nasal sewing machine inhales and exhales paused for a moment. In the hall, the volume on Kuntz's small Sony was turned down, and Henry Bowers could sense him, head cocked to one side, one hand on the TV's volume knob, the fingers of the other hand touching the cylinder which bulged in the right-hand pocket of his whites, the roll of quarters.
You don't have to talk out loud, Henry, Vic said. I can hear you if you just think, and they can't hear me at all.
What do you want, Vic? Henry asked. There was no reply for a long time. Henry thought that maybe Vic had gone away. Outside the door, the volume of Kuntz's TV went up again. Then there was a scratching noise from under the bed. The spring squealed slightly as a dark shadow pulled itself out from under. Vic looked up at him and grinned. Henry grinned back uneasily. Old Vic was looking a little bit like the Frankenstein monster himself these days. A scar like a hang rope tattoo circled his neck. Henry thought maybe that was where his head had been sewed back on. His eyes were a weird gray-green color, and the corneas seemed to float on a watery, viscous substance. Vic was still 12.
I want the same thing you want, Vic said. I want to pay him back.
Pay him back, Henry Bowers said dreamily.
But you'll have to get out of here to do it, Vic said. You'll have to go back to Derry. I need you, Henry. We all need you.
They can't hurt you, Henry said, understanding he was talking to more than Vic.
They can't hurt me if they only half believe, Vic said. But there have been some distressing signs, Henry. We didn't think they could beat us back then, either. But the fat boy got away from you in the Barrens. The fat boy and the smart mouth and the quiff got away from us that day after the movies. And the rock fight, when they saved the nigger.
Don't talk about that, Henry shouted at Vic. And for a moment, all of the peremptory hardness that had made him their leader was in his voice. Then he cringed, thinking Vic would hurt him. Surely Vic could do whatever he wanted, since he was a ghost. But Vic only grinned.
I can take care of them if they only half believe, he said. But you're alive, Henry. You can get them no matter if they believe, half believe, or don't believe at all. You can get them one by one or all at once. You can pay them back.
Pay them back, Henry repeated. Then he looked at Vic doubtfully again.
But I can't get out of here, Vic. There's wire on the windows, and Kuntz is on the door tonight. Kuntz is the worst. Maybe tomorrow night.
Don't worry about Kuntz, Vic said, standing up. Henry saw he was still wearing the jeans he had been wearing that day, and that they were still splattered with drying sewer muck.
I'll take care of Kuntz.
Vic held out his hand. After a moment, Henry took it. He and Vic walked toward the blue ward door and the sound of the TV. They were almost there when Jimmy Donlan, who had eaten his mother's brains, woke up. His eyes widened as he saw Henry's late-night visitor. It was his mother. Her slip was showing just a quarter inch or so, as it always had. The top of her head was gone. Her eyes, horribly red, rolled toward him, and when she grinned, Jimmy saw the lipstick smears on her yellow horsey teeth, as he always had. Jimmy began to shriek, "No, Ma, no, Ma, no, Ma." End of side 16.